broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network. This is Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth about the drug war. My name is Dean Becker. Steve Nolan is our engineer. And our guest for this evening is Rich Watkins, senior warden at the Holiday Prison Unit here in Texas. And in just a couple of moments, we'll hear from Barbara Markham about the war on drugs on trial right here in Houston, Texas. Steve, if you would, play that track for us, please.
Bizarre news about the U.S. policy on controlling heroin, featuring Glenn Greenway.
7% of the Afghan population is directly involved in opium production and expects even more production next year. On Thursday, the Worcester Telegram and Gazette reported that prior to the year 2000, heroin was barely a blip as far as local courts, police, and detoxes were concerned. Now, heroin use is a mountain on the charts, a trend echoed in courts up and down the East Coast. The New York Times reported on Saturday that the Afghani opium market is now so saturated that prices have fallen by 65%. Finally, doctors in Scotland reported last week that a pregnant 16-year-old addict had been infected by flesh-eating bacteria from a hit of contaminated heroin. This is Glenn Greenway reporting for the Drug Truth Network.
We do have in studio with us at this time Warden Rich Watkins. Welcome, sir.
Glad to be here.
I did a preliminary interview with the warden, and we found many points in common. And you are a member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, and for those who may not heard, tell us about that organization, please.
Basically, that's a diverse group of individuals throughout the nation who have recognized the reality of this so-called drug war, and recognized the reality of how the so-called drug war is impacting our nation, and have band together to deal with this issue primarily through the elimination of prohibition.
As a warden, as a man with a lot of experience within the criminal justice system, tell us your perceptions. Who are we sending to prison and why?
Well, we're sending a group of individuals to prison, many of whom, my personal belief, don't need to be incarcerated. They need to be in treatment programs. We have people who are actively involved in the use of drugs. We have folks who are drug users, and we have those individuals who fall into a category of between the drug users and who are listed initially as based upon their violation, but have other run-ins with the law based upon their drug use. As an example, I'm not sure that the statistics on the number of people who are actually incarcerated because of their drug involvement is accurate by any means.
Well, I did an interview with Chuck Rosenthal here in a couple of weeks back, and we talked about that thought. That he told me he doesn't keep statistics. He doesn't know if they're having any success in ending this drug war. As he said, when the only tool you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Well, unfortunately, that's true. I'm not sure that the reality of where we are as far as those people who are incarcerated are being recognized. I don't know if the reality exists there at the levels of government that it needs to be, but I really don't think that all too often the statistics are not kept because there's no interest in really knowing the truth about this thing.
Yes, sir, there's not. Per our discussions, I consider you to be a man who tries to create respect, who probably garners a lot of respect for the work that you do. And yet, the stories come out in the New York Times and the Washington Post and other papers comparing some of the abuses in these Iraqi prisons with what goes on in the many of the prisons here in the U.S. There is some validity to those comparisons, is there not?
Well, I think in recent actual cases where there have been video accounts of some of the abuses that have occurred even in the Houston area. We have to recognize that's the truth. But I would suspect that the rampant abuse that's been portrayed all too often is in fact not the truth. Prison, of course, is not a nice place to be. The facility that I work at, we're very proud of the kind of things that we do there. And you mentioned respect. That's kind of the basis from which we work. We require staff to respect themselves, and we require staff to respect the offenders. Thereby, we can have an environment where we can work with the offenders to help them alter their behavior. But I just don't think that the kinds of vast numbers of very hostile accounts that people might believe exist do exist. I know pretty much what happens in Texas because, you know, we've been involved in this process for over 20 years now, and we know how the courts came in and required the state to revamp the prison system here. Sure, there are very serious consequences for those staff members who don't abide by the law and do those things in a professional manner.
Yes, sir. It occurs to me that and they cut back on the funds for treatment just this year, did they not?
That's true. That's very unfortunate, Dean, because, you know, the reality is that we, depending upon who you talk to, we have anywhere from 142 to 162,000 people incarcerated in prisons in Texas. Those folks are not going to just die and disappear off the face of Texas. They are going to come back to your neighborhood and my neighborhood all over this state. So here we're shooting ourselves in the foot by not providing the kind of atmosphere that will help those folks deal with their situations, help them to alter their behavior, and to come back to our neighborhoods as good, viable citizens.
Yes, Warden, I want to interrupt our discussion here for a moment. Steve tells me we do have Barbara Markham online, and let's go ahead and bring her on air. Can you hear us, Barbara?
Yes, I can.
Welcome to Cultural Baggage. Today was the first day of this investigation of what happened both in the crime lab and in Chambers County. Tell us a bit about it, if you will, please.
A little bit about it goes back to 1996, 1997, when you had what their favorite informant was fabricating cases. Narcotic delivery cases against innocent citizens up in Liberty County and in Polk County. And that's the crux of it. I informed my supervisors at the Narcotics Task Force there in Chambers County, and I promptly got fired for it. And here we are 7 years later putting on, actually it's a legal malpractice case, we're putting on the original whistleblower case. It's a case within a case.
Yes, it is. And if you will, tell us some of the problems that you reported.
I reported the racial focus of the narcotic investigations, both highway interdiction and undercover dope cases. And some months it was 70% Afro-American, and some months it was 100% Afro-American, month to month, year to year. I also reported the fraudulent statistics were being submitted to the governor's office in Washington, D.C. for burn grant fund money to continually fund the task force.
So you're saying they over counted the amount seized, the number of people arrested?
No, they didn't overcount. They utilized anybody that actually made a drug case in those counties, even though they were unrelated to the task force, as productivity by the task force, when that in fact was not true.
I heard a story coming out of the Bahamas that the DEA and the Florida police and everybody was counting each bus. So, you know, they were getting two and three times the actual number as well.
Right. Same thing was going on in Chambers County. Case logs prove it. Testimony from others in the past have proven it.
Now, it's very early on. This just started today. Were there any points made, anything that you could tell us that happened
today?
The
only points made were it was opening statements started around 3 o'clock. They put on the first live witness, Blair Brininger, who was the original attorney who completely garfed up the whistleblower back in 1999. And that was only about 45 minutes to an hour of testimony. Tomorrow will be a full day of testimony.
Well, very good. I hope you will report back to us often, and I'm going to try to get myself down to that courtroom as well. This is a miniature drug war on trial, is it not?
Yes, it is.
Barbara,
with all the bad corruption
Barbara Markham, we thank you so much for giving us this report, and we'll be in touch here real soon.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Warden Watkins, you have some knowledge of this situation in Chambers County as well. This knowledge just kind of bubbles up, doesn't it? I mean, it's from the dregs.
Unfortunately, it does. And unfortunately, Chambers County does not have a good track record in being professional and fair in law enforcement. I mean, historical. You know, I'm a native Texan, and I've heard horror stories about that situation for a lot of years.
And it's rampant. It's all across America. I'm on this mailing list that does a weekly report on police corruption across America, and there's a dozen people convicted every week for corruption. We've taken the dreams of many of these law enforcement officers, started out wanting to serve society, and distracted them and ruined their attitude with all this potential money.
Well, and that is, I think, a very critical point in my mind. Anytime you have the kind of money involved in drugs that we have involved in drugs in our society, the propensity for corruption and misuse and abuse is always there. I think, by and large, that a majority of our law enforcement people are professional folks who do an excellent job. But the unfortunate thing is that we will have folks who might not have the kind of will and determination to abstain from taking advantage of opportunities where there are large amounts of money involved. So that propensity is there, and I believe that as long as we have the kind of economic involvement with drugs, things are not going to get better. They're only going to get worse.
There are better ways to rehabilitate. That's supposed to be part of what we do in our prisons. And yet, from what I understand, there's very little of that available. The money's just not there. What have you been able to do with your limited budget, sir?
You know, there's a belief that the mother of invention is opportunity through challenge.
Yes.
That's just a little differently put. We've been challenged in this state, as in this nation. We've had a severe strain on our economic situation. You can see the battle that exists between funding our prisons and funding our public schools. Our agency has taken, the prison system has taken a cut just about every year. There's a prediction of another 5% cut. So what has to happen here is that if we are going to be able to not only survive and to do a halfway decent job, we're going to have to find different ways to do it. This budget cut is not all bad. Now, I'm sure that is a very unpopular statement for those, you know, to those people who work within the prison system. But it has given, I think, a new light on doing things different. You see, unfortunately, all too often through the years, we've tried to do the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. I mean, I think that's the definition of insanity. But so I think we have been insane there. So here we have opportunities to look at different ways, better ways to do things. If we don't have the staff, let us depend more on volunteers. There are a lot of other things that we can do with the staff that we have. But we're going to have to get outside of the box and look at different ways to take advantage of really the challenges that we have.
I'll tell you what, we're going to take a short little break. We'll be back in 1 minute.
Okay. Maybe a little of the money I spend on marijuana winds up in the bad guy's hands.
Correct.
And that's because marijuana is illegal.
Exactly.
When I buy beer, that doesn't support terror because it's legal, right?
Now you got it.
So you're saying if we make marijuana legal and regulate it like beer, it wouldn't support violence?
Did I say that?
Marijuana prohibition. Harmless. Contact the Marijuana Policy Project, MPP.org. It's time to play Name That Drug by its Side Effects. Inability to control one's mind. Panic attacks. Hot surges. Nightmares. Obsessive thoughts. Emotionlessness. Dizzy. Fearful thoughts of suicide. Time's up. The answer. Prozac. Paxil. And a host of other SSRIs. Another FDA-approved product.
This is George McMahon, a federal recipient of of medical marijuana. Please speak up. Stand up.
If you would like to get a CD copy of this or any of our programs featuring judges, scientists, doctors, lawyers, people from all over the world to share with Redneck Uncle Bubba, please visit unvarnishedtruth.org.
All right, folks, you are listening to Cultural Baggage. My name's Dean Becker. Our guest tonight is Rich Watkins, Senior Warden at the Holiday Prison Unit here in Texas. Warden, we were talking a bit earlier about this. Many times a person's busted in Houston and he winds up in prison in Amarillo. And it's a very great hardship on his family, and it destroys the continuity of family. Let's talk on that subject for a moment.
Okay. With over 140,000 people incarcerated, one thing I don't think many people recognize is there are only, by virtue of numbers, a few counties that house prison facilities. And until recently, they were primarily in Southeast Texas. But due to the big expansion in the prison population, they were expanded to other parts like Amarillo and Abilene and down in South Texas. So with that many people incarcerated, beds dictate where you will be able to place these folks. The unfortunate thing is that the agency is not able to place them because of the capacity that we have in those areas many times that are accessible to their families. I work visitation every third weekend, and I have an opportunity to see people who travel all the way from South Texas. Some come from Louisiana and Oklahoma and other places. So what we try to do as an agency is establish an environment where these convicted felons maintain contact with their families. That's a very critical part of their evolving back into the free society, because, you know, you've seen these stories like Shankshaw Redemption, where an individual has been locked up for so long until they don't realize that things have changed. So in order to help facilitate a positive readaptation to the real world, it's critical that they maintain contact with their family and their friends. This is part, in my thinking, this is a very critical part of them maintaining contact with reality and helping them to make that transition back into the free world.
I think it was 2 weeks ago, Texas Senator John Whitmire had a story in the Houston Chronicle saying that according to the statistics and the rate of growth, we're going to have to build more prisons again next year.
Well, there has to be a better way. First of all, you know, as I mentioned earlier, you know, we're looking at the competition between dollars to incarcerate somebody and dollars to educate our most valuable assets, our children. And, you know, the special session, you know, whether it was going to be successful or was successful, that's debatable. But the issue here is that I can recall a time that we grew from less than 12,000 offenders to over 140,000. I mean, we're going in the wrong direction there. Those of us who are taxpayers, I don't think we can bear that burden just from an economic point of view. But I don't think our society can afford to continue to do that. Well, there's apparently a push, you know, in Austin to not fund any more new construction. So what has happened here apparently is that to preclude new construction in any immediate period of time, beds are being added to existing prison units, which further provide for additional crowding. So Senator Whitmire is probably correct in his projections, but I suggest that we can't keep going in that direction. We can't keep locking up folks and expecting that, you know, that they're going to be able to make a positive transition back into life.
Well, when we set them up, so to speak, by turning them loose with, what, $50 or a bus ticket, and expect them to just go succeed. And if they've been locked up for 10 or 20 years, they don't even know how to run a computer, probably. Some of them, this is a new world, as you say. And yet, you know, they can't get a job without, they don't have credentials, they can't get an education, they can't even get housing or credit in many cases, because they're still paying that debt to society.
Well, you know, there's a little glimmer of light at the end of the tunnel. I think you were at the conference that we talked about earlier, the Breaking Chains conference at Texas Southern, and you probably recall the lady who had been incarcerated for, I think, about 12 years. She got out, and she's devoting her life now to helping convicted felons, helping prepare them to get a job and provide an environment where employers will employ these folks. She's been very successful in the Dallas area, and I think over the next few months she's going to have that project expanded to Houston. These are the kinds of things that we as a society are going to have to do, because, you know, if we expect folks to be able to come and to readapt their life and become good citizens, I mean, it's incumbent upon us as citizens to help provide an environment both while in prison and after they get out of prison that does not keep that X on their back, but allow them to make appropriate changes. And I suggest the majority of the folks that just want to come back, they've recognized they've made an error, they want to do that time, they want to come back to their families, work, and earn a living.
Yes, sir, that X on their back, absolutely right. You know, I think of the scenario. I use this often. What would you rather have living next door to you? Somebody who sells marijuana or somebody who just got out of prison for 10 years for selling marijuana? I mean, the violent behavior many times comes about through that experience in prison.
You know, unfortunately, that's true, Dean, because as good a prison as we feel we run at the Holiday Unit, prison is not a good place to be. I mean, you're forced to live with people from a diverse community who are all convicted felons for some reason or the other. Unfortunately, there are those people who look for an opportunity to recruit folks to their own beliefs. There's a violent society that exists within prison, even though we do an outstanding job overall in maintaining a decent place for these folks to do that time. But we deal with a tremendous amount of hostility. So it's not a good place. It's not a good place. And this is something that I think is an opportunity for us to try to get involved in, to become more knowledgeable about what's happening and try to provide an atmosphere that's going to be conducive for these folks.
Yes, sir. In regards to marijuana, I'm sure that's those in prison, many of them are there through use of marijuana or having got caught while on probation or parole using marijuana. Let's talk about that. Are you aware of a number that come into prison for that reason?
There are a significant number of people who are incarcerated who've been involved in drugs, marijuana use, as well as cocaine and others. There are some real horror stories, but I think the reality is that you know, it's incumbent upon us to recognize and to keep accurate statistics on who we have incarcerated, why they're there, and that should give us a clue on what we can do to try to help these folks.
Sure, to just be able to track success of alternatives being tried.
That's true.
Yes, sir. Now, prohibition, it has an 89-year history. It certainly didn't work with alcohol. Why can we not recognize the need for change at this time?
Unfortunately, so much about the criminal justice system is emotional. It's not based upon fact or reason. It's based upon hearsay perceptions. You know, I get asked often, is my prison like the prison that was in Oz? Well, no, that prison doesn't exist, I don't think, anywhere in the state of Texas. But there are those perceptions out there. And as long as there are perceptions based upon beliefs and not facts, we're going to have some unrealistic kinds of situations. So here, that's a big challenge.
Yes, sir. Now, you touched on this earlier. It was, Justice William Wayne Justice, if I've got that right, who kind of held the hammer over the Texas prison system for a while. Similar situations are developing in other states. California is now having a major row with their prison guards union. They've actually elected the last couple of governors out there through their campaign contributions. have we allowed too much authority, too much of a bully pulpit to evolve around those who enforce the laws and carry them out?
I think our whole criminal justice system has a lot to be responsible for. I think we probably have more control, as far as Texas is concerned, in the prison system than we do any other portion of the criminal justice system, because we have been under court order. A lot of people object to this, but as far as I'm concerned, Judge Justice was one of my heroes, still is, because he might or might not have believed in all the things that he had to establish, but he is a jurist of the highest caliber, and he knows that in order to have the kind of system that we were going to have in Texas, he was going to have to come down hard, and he did that. So my hat goes off to the man.
Yes, sir. In my youth, even just being in the Harris County Jail back in the late 60s, early 70s was a small trip to hell. I really want to tell you. It was a running rampant. The BTs ran the tanks, selected the teenage boys they wanted for the evening. It was a really horrendous place. And I could only imagine what the prisons were like during that time.
Well, this was the thing that precipitated Judge Justice's wrath, and that was what they call the building tender system. Anytime you have violent people in charge of other folks, you're going to have violence, and I can certainly identify with what you shared. That could happen today, but unlikely, because of the kinds of changes that Judge Justice instituted that established a prison where people are incarcerated as punishment and not to be punished. One where they are allowed to be provided with a safe and humane place to do their time. And I think Texas overall can be proud of that.
Yes, sir. We have made good progress. I agree with you, sir. All right. Well, Steve tells me we got about a minute left, and I wanted to alert folks to where they can learn more about law enforcement against prohibition, the outfit that the warden is a member of, and that's at leap.cc. That's LEAP.cc. And there are stories there. There are many recordings of this program. I have had now 9 members of law enforcement against prohibition on this show. These are people, judges, district attorneys, policemen, wardens, others within the criminal justice system. It's now well over 7,000 strong on a worldwide membership. And these people speak with authority and experience and great knowledge, and I would hope that we would heed their words in this regard. Warden Watkins, I want to thank you for being on Culture Baggage. Any closing thoughts? We got a few seconds.
Well, it's just a pleasure to be here, and we try to tell this story where we go, that we can't keep doing the same thing expecting a different result. We're going to have to do differently.
Yes, sir. This is absolutely right. And to all my listeners out there, I want to thank you for joining us today on Cultural Baggage. This drug war is going to end when you wake up and do your little part. It's not going to take much, a little effort. And as always, because of drug prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag. And I urge you to please be careful.
For the Drug Truth Network, and on behalf of my technical producer, Steve Nolan, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth. This show is produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT from Houston. Tap dancing on the edge of an abyss.